Hey, Kristen, how's it tracking?
With Carvana Value Tracker?
What else?
Oh, it's tracking. In fact, Value Surge Alert, trucks up 2.5%. Vans down 1.7%.
Just as predicted.
Mm-hmm.
So, we gonna...
I don't know. Could sell, could hold.
The power to always know our car's worth.
Exhilarating, isn't it?
Tracking.
Always know your car's worth with Carvana Value Tracker.
When we first meet the family in the opening minutes of the film, they're moving into a large Rhode Island farmhouse that seems perfect for them. It's on a nice piece of land with lots of room for their five daughters, and yes, it was expensive for 1970, but Roger and Carolyn Perrin know it's going to be worth it. It's a house where their girls, Andrea, Nancy, Christine, Cindy, and April, could grow up, and a place where maybe they'd live for the rest of their lives. But things seem ominous when they arrive, when their dog Sadie refuses to enter the house. The family soon discovers a boarded-up cellar, and paranormal events occur within the first few nights. Every clock in the house stops at 3:07 a.m. Carolyn wakes up with new bruises each morning, and then Sadie is found dead in the yard. Then Carolyn and Christine both encounter a malevolent spirit. Carolyn then contacts renowned demonologists Ed and Lorraine Warren, during which Lorraine, who's a clairvoyant, sees that a dark spirit has attached itself to the family so that even leaving the house won't free them of its terrible influence. Research soon reveals that the house once belonged to a witch and a child murderer named Bathsheba Sherman, who sacrificed her week-old baby to the devil and then committed suicide in 1863 at 3:07 a.m. Before she hung herself in the backyard, she cursed everyone who would ever inhabit her land. And since that time, there have been reports of murders and suicides in the houses that were built on the property. During a seance in the cellar with the Warrens, Carolyn is possessed by Bathsheba. Lorraine sees the spirit of a woman that Bathsheba had possessed long ago and forced to kill her child, realizing she'll force Carolyn to do the same. The Warrens conclude they have sufficient evidence to receive authorization from the Catholic Church to perform an exorcism, but Father Gordon explains that approval would have to come directly from the Vatican because the Perrin family are not members of the church. Scared out of their home, the Perrin family takes refuge at a motel, but Carolyn, still possessed, takes Christine and April back to the house to kill them. As a warning to the Warrens not to interfere, their daughter Judy is attacked by Bathsheba, but that doesn't stop them, and they rush to the house to help. Carolyn is tied to a chair, and Ed attempts the exorcism himself. Carolyn escapes and attempts to kill April, but Lorraine is able to call to her by reminding her of a family memory, allowing Ed to complete the exorcism and send Bathsheba back to hell. And the Perrin family lives happily ever after. Maybe. But who can say for sure? Because, of course, this is based on a true story. But how true is this story? Well, as you're about to hear, not very. Truth, as they say, is often much stranger than fiction. But in some cases, you actually have to find the truth first. And when it comes to The Conjuring and with Ed and Lorraine Warren themselves, the truth is a very, very elusive thing. Welcome to American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. And welcome to the latest episode of Season 9, a season we call Based on a True Story. American Hauntings is written and performed by Troy Taylor, that's me, and is produced and co-hosted by Cody Beck, which is not me. Just kidding. And this season, we're bringing you some of the scariest and most unsettling films about ghosts, demons, murder, and mayhem that have ever been shown on the silver screen. But you can't watch any of them and say, it's only a movie. Every episode of this season will offer the true story behind these terrifying films, which are even scarier than anything a movie studio can create. This is episode 7 of season 9, The Conjuring. I should probably begin this part of the episode by saying there are so many different things between the Conjuring film and the story that was documented by Andrea Perrin in the book she wrote called House of Darkness, House of Light, that the only things you might recognize reading the books are the names. For whatever reason, only the bare bones of the story were used to make the film, and instead the screenplay was based on the case files of Ed and Lorraine Warren, which, in addition to being suspect for a variety of reasons, were also incomplete, as you'll soon find out. But here are some facts about the story that aren't disputed. Roger and Carolyn Perrin purchased the 14-room farmhouse and the attached 200 acres of land in December 1970 for $72,000, which was a considerable sum at the time. The house was located outside of Harrisville, near the Massachusetts border. The house was completed in 1736, although the property was originally deeded in 1680 and was owned until 1970 by members of the Richardson and Arnold families. The Perrins were believed to be the first owners with no family connection to the previous owners of what had been called the Richardson House, the Old Arnold Estate, and Old Brook Farm. Carolyn had been the one who found the listing for the colonial home, and the entire family had visited the farm several times before they purchased it. They didn't experience anything otherworldly or strange about the place until the day they moved in. The family believed it was as if the spirits were waiting for them to arrive before making their presence known. Well, since Carolyn didn't want to disrupt the Christmas holidays for the kids, the move to the new house didn't happen until January 1971, and unfortunately, it was a cold and snowy day when they arrived with the moving truck. In her book, Andrea described what happened when she took a moving box into the house for the first time. The box had been marked with the word kitchen, so she went into the closest door to the kitchen, where her mother was with her baby sister April, who was only 5 and too small to help carry boxes. On the way to the kitchen, she encountered Mr. Kenyon, whose family lived in the house before the parents. He was packing a box with his wife's china, which was still in a hutch. She chatted with him for a moment before continuing toward the kitchen. As she passed through the front foyer, she saw a man standing there who was oddly dressed. Aside from that, there was nothing unusual about the way he looked, and as she walked past him, she said, "Good morning, sir." She walked into the kitchen and later remembered asking her mother who the man was with Mr. Kenyon. Carolyn's response was, "There's nobody with Mr. Kenyon. His son is on the way, but he's not here yet." But Andrea assumed that a neighbor had stopped by and her mother just didn't know it. She returned to the moving truck, and as she did, she passed her sister Christine, coming from the opposite direction with a moving box of her own. When she entered the house, she saw the same man standing in the corner of the front foyer and asked Carolyn the same thing that Andrea had. Carolyn was busy, having just discovered that Mr. Kenyon hadn't packed anything in the kitchen yet, so she didn't pay much attention to her. Well, until Cindy walked in with a box and also asked about the man who was with Mr. Kenyon and who was dressed funny. A moment later, Nancy walked in behind Cindy and asked her sisters about the man, and then added, "He just disappeared." And as Andrea put it, that became their introduction to the farm. But apparently that wasn't the only strange thing that happened that day. Just before Mr. Kenyon left, he pulled Roger aside and suggested to him that, quote, "For the sake of your family, leave the lights on at night." Now, if this wasn't a story about an allegedly haunted house, most of us would likely interpret the statement the same way that Roger did, that it was a new house with one bathroom on the first floor, and with the girls sleeping upstairs, he should leave a light on so they didn't fall down the stairs in the middle of the night. Of course, the implication and context to our story is, of course, that Mr. Kenyon was warning them about the ghosts in the house. But in truth, he probably wasn't. According to the Kenyon family, nothing supernatural ever happened to them while living in the house, and there was no history of anything ghostly occurring there in the 200-plus years that their ancestors had lived there either. But we'll come back to that. While the family was starting to get settled in the house, strange occurrences were beginning to take place. They heard noises, footsteps, and scraping sounds. A broom would disappear and then reappear in the kitchen. Small piles of dirt materialized from nowhere on newly cleaned floors. They would eventually come to believe the family was sharing the house with at least a dozen different spirits. Some of them became very familiar because they saw them over and over again, although the man they saw on the day they moved in was only seen that one time. It wasn't frightening, Andrea said, and he seemed to be focused on Mr. Kenyon. Other spirits, though, were a lot more unnerving. After only a few nights in the house, Cindy crawled into bed with Andrea in the middle of the night, obviously upset. She was only 8 years old at the time and asked if she could sleep with her. Andrea agreed and asked her what was wrong. Cindy said she kept hearing voices in her room and they kept getting louder and louder. She couldn't believe that Andrea hadn't heard them. The house was drafty and not very warm upstairs, so they had the doors to the rooms open to keep the heat moving and not trapped in one room or another. Cindy was sharing a room with her sister, Christine, who had a tendency to talk in her sleep, so Andrea assumed that that was what Cindy heard, made spookier by the darkness of a new room and a new house. Well, that was until Christine started reporting the voices, too. She told Andrea they kept repeating the same thing. There are 7 dead soldiers buried in the wall. There are 7 dead soldiers buried in the wall. Over and over and over. The voices were all in monotone, speaking at the same time. And the more times they repeated that line, the louder they became, coming from all around her bed to the point that the bed and the floorboards were shaking. She tried to put her pillow over her head to muffle the sound, but when she couldn't tolerate it anymore, she jumped up and ran out of the room. What these spirits were trying to say, Andrea didn't understand for many years because there was nothing that could have been inside the walls of the house. The walls were clapboard with horsehair plaster over them and no place for anything to be stored or hidden. A few years ago, though, there were reports that ground-penetrating radar did find 7 anomalies under a stone wall behind the house that some believe are graves. Due to Rhode Island laws about exhumations, though, the idea that 7 dead soldiers are buried under that particular wall has never been proven or disproven. Unfortunately, the same can't be said for many of the other purportedly historical facts about the house. But again, we'll come back to that. As the strange events on the farm began to intensify, Carolyn decided to investigate the history of the farm, and Andrea would use her mother's research when she later wrote her books about their time in the house. But Carolyn's research was mostly what she could do on her own back in the early 1970s, when history was a lot harder to research than it is today. Access to newspapers was limited, and so a lot of her research consisted of word-of-mouth stories from neighbors, local folklore, and stories for which the only confirmation would come, was through psychics. Well, at one point, Carolyn was said to have been given information by a local historian that has since turned out not to exist. It's possible that the name that was given for this man, which was McKirchen, was a pseudonym. But if that's true, his information turned out later to be as untrue as most of what Carolyn was able to gather from random locals on the street. According to their version of events, at least a dozen mysterious deaths had occurred on the property, including the murders of an infant and child, a suicide in the attic, and multiple drownings in a nearby creek. Not surprisingly, those tragic souls, Carolyn believed, were now tied to the property in the form of the ghosts encountered by the family, or, well, most of the family anyway. Roger reportedly never experienced anything otherworldly in their home and would often ask Andrea to refrain from speaking about her ghostly experiences. But that was a pretty common feeling for most people at that time. The parents never talked about what was happening in their home, and according to Andrea, despite what most information about the case claims, they never sought out paranormal investigators to visit their home. Carolyn always stated that she never called anyone, and only their closest friends knew about the strange happenings, and that included their attorney and the girl's babysitter. It wasn't something that most people talked about back then, at least not the adults. Now, the kids at school knew about it, Andrea claimed, since the house had a reputation. But she insists that Carolyn never asked anyone to come and investigate the farm. And yet, they did show up. About 2.5 years after the parents moved in, a group of college students showed up at their door one day. Keith Johnson, his brother, and a group of friends who were paranormal investigators came one afternoon and asked to look around. Johnson would always say that Carolyn called and invited them, but Carolyn said she didn't. So who can say which story is accurate? Well, regardless of what happened to get them there, the team from Rhode Island College began their investigations of the house. In addition to collecting stories from the parents, they also claimed to witness a variety of phenomena, including objects that moved on their own, unexplained noises, and strange odors. A psychic medium that came with them on one occasion reportedly communicated with several of the spirits, including a child and a woman she described as being demented. Andrea believed this was the spirit that the family had encountered who smelled like rotting flesh. Carolyn apparently felt this spirit was behind the mysterious deaths that occurred on the property and directed the other spirits who were present. In one interview, she noted that the spirit perceived herself as the mistress of the house and resented Carolyn because she saw her as someone trying to take over that position. And then one night, just before Halloween 1973, two new visitors showed up at the door one night, Ed and Lorraine Warren. The family hadn't contacted them either. The Warrens were doing a lecture tour that fall and had made a stop at the University of Rhode Island. The first group that had come to investigate the house told the Warrens about what was happening and where the parent family lived. When they arrived, Carolyn let them into the house. It was very cold outside, so she offered them a cup of coffee, assuming they were lost because the farm was pretty remote in 1973. But the Warrens quickly identified themselves as the world's most renowned demonologists and paranormal investigators. Carolyn had never heard of them and had no idea who they were. And if you think that things have already been a little different than you recall from the plot of the movie, just wait. You ain't seen nothing yet. A pair of conniving, reality-distorting, shamelessly grandiose self-promoters and sham psychics running a long-term con job. That's just one of the kinder opinions of Ed and Lorraine Warren that's floating around out there in the ether these days. I'm going to leave that one alone, but I will tell you that the characters that appear in the Conjuring films are a far cry from real life. In the films, they are portrayed as kind, soulful people who are just here to help, but reality paints them in a much different light. Now, I'm not going to dig too deep into their biographies here. You can find out more about them in our Amityville Horror episode from season 8, but I will say that Ed Warren was a self-taught and self-professed demonologist, author, and lecturer, while Lorraine professed to be clairvoyant and a light trance medium. In 1952, the pair established the New England Society for Psychical Research, and for a couple of decades, they were pretty much the only game in town when it came to ghosts and demons and the supernatural. They cashed in on that fact for years, doing a lot of self-promotion and exploiting families for personal gain. So, as you might guess, I've never been a fan, but we'll admit they were in the right place at the right time to take advantage of the interest that Americans had in the supernatural when there were a few other options to choose from. The fact that they were swindlers who preyed on vulnerable families, feeding them fantastical tales and creating narratives from which they themselves could benefit, that's just the icing on the cake. Just as an example of what I mean is something that actually plays a small part in the cold open of the film, the allegedly cursed doll Annabelle, which sits in a glass case in the Warren's Occult Museum in Monroe, Connecticut. She looks nothing like the terrifying doll depicted in the Conjuring films, though. She's actually a Raggedy Ann doll, locked in a case with a sign on it that reads, "Warning, positively do not open." There is scant information about the haunting connected to the doll, other than what's been provided by the Warrens, but the Raggedy Ann doll was allegedly given to a nursing student by her mother in 1970. When the doll began exhibiting strange behavior, a medium revealed it was possessed by a dead woman named Annabelle Higgins. The student and her roommate felt sorry for the doll and granted Annabelle permission to reside within it. However, when frightening events continued to occur, they contacted the Warrens, who declared that Annabelle Higgins was not a ghost at all. She was, of course, a demon. Well, Ed, who'd been referring to himself as a demonologist by that time, even though he had no education or training in the subject, took the doll with plans to lock it up inside the museum for safekeeping. But they didn't get far before they had their first paranormal experience with the doll. After leaving the nurse's apartment, the Warrens buckled Annabelle into the back seat of the car and decided not to take the busy highway home in case there was some malevolent power that might affect them or their vehicle still attached to Annabelle. But even the safer back roads proved to be dangerous. On their way home, Lorraine claimed that the brakes failed several times, resulting in near disastrous crashes. The only thing that saved them was when Ed finally pulled a bottle of holy water from his demonologist bag and doused the doll with it. When they got home, Annabelle was initially placed in Ed's office, but they claimed the doll soon began levitating and moving around the house. Even when they placed it in an outer building, the Warrens claimed she would later turn up inside the house anyway. Finally, they decided to lock Annabelle up for good. They had a special wood and glass case built for her that had the Lord's Prayer and St. Michael's Prayer inscribed on it. And for the rest of his life, Ed periodically said a binding prayer over the case, ensuring that the sinister spirit inside the doll would remain trapped. Well, after being locked up, Annabelle didn't move again, but it was alleged that the spirit managed to find ways to wreak havoc anyway. Once a priest who visited the Warrens Museum discounted her demonic powers, even after Ed warned him about mocking Annabelle. But the young priest just laughed it off, and then on his way home, he was involved in a near-fatal crash that totaled his new car. He claimed he'd seen Annabelle in his rearview mirror just before the accident. Years later, another visitor rapped on the glass of Annabelle's case and laughed at how silly people were to believe in her. On his way home, he reportedly lost control of his motorcycle and crashed into a tree, killing him instantly. Well, the Warrens recounted these stories for years as proof of Annabelle's terrible powers, but whether they're truth or fiction is unknown because no names or evidence to corroborate these stories was ever offered. We only have the Warrens' word for the fact these events took place, and they have, well, let's just say a complicated relationship with the truth. Especially when we look at how strikingly similar the Annabelle story is to a 1963 episode of The Twilight Zone, in which a woman named Annabelle gives her daughter a doll that comes to life and terrorizes her family. But let's get back to the Perrin family. Despite the fact that Carolyn had no idea who Ed and Lorraine Warren were, that didn't prevent the couple from going into their usual performance mode. According to Andrea, Lorraine walked over to the old black stove that was in the kitchen, put one hand on the stove and the other hand over her eyes, and quietly said that she sensed a malignant entity in the house and that its name was Bathsheba. Andrea always maintained that Lorraine knew absolutely nothing about the history of the house or the area, and that Lorraine just plucked the name out of thin air. Trust me when I tell you she didn't. It's one of the oldest tricks in the book. If you want to convince someone you magically know something you're not supposed to know, you just make sure you have all your ducks in a row before you arrive. The Perrin family assumed that Lorraine didn't know the name because they didn't realize she'd already heard it from the paranormal investigators who originally got them involved in the case. They'd already filled the Warrens in on what was happening, and they knew about Bathsheba because Carolyn had told them all about her. Her name had turned up during Carolyn's research, which was, of course, as we mentioned, really just collecting local lore. The story that Carolyn was telling was that Bathsheba Sherman had lived in the house in the 19th century and had a dark reputation as a witch. She'd killed an infant, possibly her own, with a knitting needle to the back of the skull, but was acquitted at trial due to lack of evidence. Well, for years, she brutally beat and starved her farmhands, and then, after drowning one of her children in the house's basement well as a sacrifice to the devil, she hung herself. Lorraine Warren had, of course, devoured this information, and from then on, the presence haunting the house was always referred to as Bathsheba by Lorraine and, well, pretty much everyone else involved. Once, when Carolyn experienced a sudden piercing pain in her leg while lying on the sofa, and when the spot was checked, A perfectly round hole was found. It was as if a large sewing needle had punctured her skin. Lorraine suggested that Bathsheba could have taken the needle she used to kill that baby with to the afterlife, and now she was using it to harm Carolyn. Oh boy. The Warrens made multiple trips to the parent house to try and spiritually cleanse the place of evil. At one point, Lorraine led a bizarre seance in which Carolyn was supposedly possessed by Bathsheba, causing her to speak in tongues and her chair to levitate and throw her across the room. Well, the hijinks continued until Roger put an end to things, fearing for his wife's mental health. He wasn't very diplomatic when he showed the Warrens to the door and told them not to return. The film, which Lorraine served as a consultant for, pays particular attention to Carolyn's alleged possession and the cleansing done by the Warrens, but in real life, they did nothing to solve the family's problems. In fact, according to Andrea, their actions made things worse. The Warrens naturally blame the parents and their lack of religious faith for that, because, well, it certainly couldn't be their fault. But curiously, despite the farm being overrun by what Lorraine called dangerous demons led by an infant-murdering witch with a knitting needle as a spectral weapon, the parents continued to live in the house until 1980. Strangely, the hauntings apparently stopped when they left, which leads many to wonder just what in the world was happening there in the 1970s. Perhaps the best place to begin is with a look at some of the real history of the house and what the Warrens claimed was the source of the haunting, Bathsheba Sherman. Bathsheba was a real woman. That part is true. She was born in 1812, but she never lived in the house or even on the property. In 1844, when she would have been considered a spinster in those days at age 32, she married Judson Sherman, with whom she had four children. Three of them died from childhood illnesses, which were tragically common at that time, and her fourth, Herbert, lived a long life as a farmer, had a family, and outlived his parents. None of her children were stabbed with needles or sacrificed to the devil. Oh, and about that needle and the dead baby, it's been claimed there was a single article about that incident and about an inquest that was held, stored in an archive somewhere. There isn't, because it never happened. Had the death occurred, it would have likely been recorded in what was known as the Black Book of Burrillville, a list of unusual deaths starting in 1806 that was compiled by historians in the township of Burrillville, where the farmhouse officially sits. Bathsheba also didn't hang herself in the backyard of the house she never lived in. She died from a stroke in May of 1885, 3 years after her husband died, and at the age of 73. There are many articles about her death, and there's no mention in any of them about her having a notorious past. Her funeral was conducted by A.H. Granger, pastor of the First Baptist Church of Providence, who was well-known and highly respected and wouldn't have presided over the funeral of a witch. In addition, Bathsheba, along with the rest of her family, was buried in the local churchyard, something that also wouldn't have happened if she'd been a witch or a devil worshiper or anything else that she's been called over the years. If the parent house really was haunted, it wasn't by Bathsheba Sherman. And there's more. Far too often, when you depend on local legends and lore as the truth, you're bound to end up disappointed. As I mentioned, though, we can't blame all of this on Carolyn Parent. She was doing the best she could with what she had to work with at the time. The fault lies in those who simply accepted those stories as truth, especially after it became so much easier to discover what was fact and what was fiction. Carolyn had discovered a list of deaths that occurred on the property over two centuries, which really isn't that surprising over that length of time, although some of them were labeled as mysterious, even though it turns out they weren't as strange as they seemed. Plus, some of the deaths attributed to the property never happened there at all. For instance, according to the stories, one of the supposed occurrences that led to the paranormal activity at the farm was the murder of a woman named Prudence Arnold when the farm was owned by Dexter Richardson. But this never happened. Dexter Richardson never owned or lived on this property. Prudence was murdered in his home, though, but that home was in Uxbridge, Massachusetts. The murder was well documented when Richardson's home was added to the National Register of Historic Places. Another supposed suicide on the property was that of John Arnold's wife, Susan. However, it's been well documented once again that she hung herself in 1866 at the age of 50 in her own home, not at the farm. Other parts of the story didn't really hold up either. As mentioned, the Kenyon family, who the parents purchased the house from, never reported any supernatural events on the property, and neither did the families who lived there after the parents moved out. Jerry and Norma Sutcliffe, who owned the house between 1987 and 2019, reported no strange occurrences. The biggest problem they had were with vandals and trespassers who started showing up almost nightly after The Conjuring was released in 2013. Norma, along with journalist Ken Spotwood, was the first to reveal the truth behind the story of Bathsheba Sherman as part of a lawsuit that she filed against Warner Brothers, the distributors of the film, who she blamed for the harassment they'd suffered after the film was released. Well, the Sutcliffes finally sold the house for $439,000 to a couple who immediately claimed the return of the demonic hauntings that had affected the Perrin family, and worse. Unlike the Sutcliffes, the ongoing Conjuring movie franchise turned out to be a goldmine for them. They sold the house just 3 years later, turning a nice profit in 2022 with a sale price of $1.5 million. That's a good profit. The house was purchased by a developer from Boston, Jacqueline Nunez, who described herself as having a fascination with the supernatural. According to various interviews that she did, the house didn't allow people to live in it year-round because the energy inside of it was so powerful. But you know what the house did allow? High-priced overnight stays, ghost tours, and investigations. The so-called Conjuring House has since turned into a commercial bonanza, but the questions about its authenticity remain. Whether the house was truly haunted in the 1970s or remains that way today is an ongoing debate. It also begs the question, how much of it is real and how much is hype? Andrea Perrin has always maintained her story is true, and perhaps she and her family really did encounter something unexplainable in the house that terrified her and continues to terrify her all these years later. Maybe, just maybe, even though the history behind the haunting is the stuff of fiction, the paranormal events that occurred in the 1970s were real. But what about today? Why would no one report ghostly happenings in the house for 40 years, only to have them suddenly manifest again 4 decades after the Perrin family moved out? Well, the reality of the current hauntings in the house, it seems to go back and forth, depending on who's telling the story. A realty company that handled the listing and sale for the house was quoted as saying, "To this day, countless happenings have been reported." However, when reporters pressed them about those countless happenings, they weren't available to provide any details or any evidence. In 2020, a reporter for the Boston Globe spent just one night in the house. A skeptic going in, she noted she was glad her stay was only one night because, quote, the place seems haunted. In 2021, a writer named Amanda Milkovitz, who was there with 2 friends, the Ghost Moms, spent the night in the house and also had strange experiences, which she wrote up in a breathless article for People magazine, which has always been known for its paranormal content. Sorry. In 2023, the Travel Channel sponsored a pair of ghost hunters to film in the former Perrin house, and they concluded, no surprise, it was still haunted. Since 2019, the house has continued to maintain its reputation as a haunted house, or rather, I should say its reputation returned after it was no longer owned by the Sutcliffes, and of course, after the film about the house was released, even though there is little in the movie that is true. Isn't it possible that what people are experiencing in this house is merely the power of suggestion? It's haunted because it's supposed to be? As we've already explored in past episodes of this podcast, legend can certainly affect fact. And as we know, people have been known to encounter the ghosts of people who never even existed at all. You know, like Chloe at the Myrtles Plantation, for instance. But theories abound about the so-called Conjuring House. Some go all the way back to the Perrin family. accusing them of making up stories or being influenced by popular films like The Exorcist to imagine strange things were happening in their old creaky house. Andrea Perrin, in particular, has been targeted as a fraud, claiming the reason she self-published her books about living in the house is because she didn't want to be exposed as perpetrating a hoax. Yeah, that's not why. And it doesn't make her a liar. I don't believe she made up the story or that her family did. The house certainly had the potential to be haunted, even if the history of the property that was cited turned out to be wrong. I'll stress again how limited the resources were for amateur historians in the 1970s. Carolyn didn't mean to spread false information, and if Lorraine Warren had really been a psychic, she would have known the stories were true. Carolyn Perrin believed the stories she was told, and so did Andrea. Just because the history they collected was inaccurate doesn't mean they were making up the events they were personally experiencing. I think it's very possible that the farm was haunted when the parents lived there. Perhaps having five young girls in the house attracted spirits in a way that someone else in the house might not have done. And perhaps when they finally left, the haunting faded away. But that's just my thoughts on it. Obviously, the involvement of Ed and Lorraine Warren cast doubts on any story. They use their version of the Perrin story to promote their books and lectures, despite their limited involvement and lack of success. What I can say in defense of Andrea Perrin is that she was smart enough early on to step away from the Warren's version of events and stick to her own story, despite what she might have been pressured to do by the Warrens and by film producers when that story went to the screen. So what's the final verdict? People are not going to stop believing the haunting continues today. The publicity is just too powerful. I mean, despite extensive investigation and numerous legal disputes that have proven the Amityville Horror story was a hoax, people still believe it's true. The evidence behind the Conjuring House haunting remains problematic. Bathsheba Sherman wasn't a witch. She didn't kill her child. She didn't hang herself in the backyard. History doesn't support the research, and there are many inconsistencies in the stories. And then there's the Warrens. I think that in many cases, people just want to believe a house is haunted because they saw it in a movie. Even though they know it's not accurate and it's been changed around for entertainment value, it's hard to shake something you've seen and experienced. In a story like this one, which we will never know the absolute truth about, perhaps it's best to look at both sides of the argument. There are more things in heaven and earth, the quote says, than are dreamed of in our philosophy. So in other words, we're never going to know the truth. So all we can do, maybe for the best, is just decide for ourselves what we want to believe and take any story we hear with a very large grain of salt, no matter how good the movie made about it might be. Thanks again for listening to American Hauntings, and we hope you'll stay tuned for the postmortem section of the episode. It's coming right up after these messages from our sponsors.
All right, it's 9:18. We're headed down into the cellar where the door's just opened on its own.
Give us a sign that you want to communicate with us.
What are you guys?
Well, we've been called ghost hunters, paranormal researchers.
But we prefer to be known simply as Ed and Lorraine Warren.
There's someone here that would like to talk to you.
There's something horrible happening in my house.
November 1st, 1971, I'm sitting here with Carolyn Perrin, who, with her family, has been experiencing supernatural occurrences.
You picking up anything in here, hon?
Something awful happened here, Ed.
What is it?
Whatever Lorraine sees, feels, touches, it takes a toll on her. A little piece each time.
You have a lot of spirits in here, but there's one that I'm most worried about because it is so hateful.
We have to get out of here.
That's not gonna help.
This thing has latched itself to your family.
Father, we never seen nothing like this.
I'm coming with you.
No way. I can't lose you.
There's a lady in a dirty nightgown that I see in my dreams. She's standing in front of my mom's bed.
Do you want to see him?
Yeah.
When the music stops, you see him in the mirror standing behind you.
This weekend, only at Macy's, it's our lowest prices of spring. How low? Diamond rings, pendants, and earrings, only $399, originally $1,500. Ninja blenders, now $89.99. And $395 men's designer suits, only $99.99. So if you're wondering why you should shop Macy's lowest prices sale, well, the name pretty much says it all. It's our lowest prices for one weekend only. Starts tomorrow at Macy's. Savings off already reduced prices. Exclusions apply.
All right, I am good to go when okay. You are.
All right. All right. Ready for a little more American Hauntings this week? Well, we're back with the American Hauntings podcast, the postmortem after the episode where we dissect this week's show. My name is Troy Taylor, and I'm the guy who narrates, writes, and conjures up this stuff. That was a pun, bad one. But, and across from me is the guy who wants you to know that the opinions of the narrator do not represent all of those of the staff and management of the American Hauntings podcast. My friend, producer, sidekick, and co-host, Cody Back.
Is that what it feels like when I make most of my jokes, like for you?
Probably, yeah. Oh, probably
I'm
so.
I'm
you
so sorry.
Just have this sinking feeling in your stomach and you think, wow, people really are going to think we're dumb. So
I know.
And they already do. So what the heck, you know, why change their opinion now?
What is it like when I say it, what is the thing where I just don't care and don't get that feeling that I give to other people? Like, I you know what I mean? Like, I
don't know, man. Lack of
it.
Shame, lack of, you know, just awareness around you.
It's self-respect.
That's what I think. Yeah, I think all of those things apply to me. So I'm not sure for you. So.
I would have said the exact same thing and not cared at all. But hearing it from somebody else, I was like,
I know.
Holy.
I know. Right. Right.
Gosh, so. I need to rethink a lot of my life. Oh, gosh. But hey, dude, hey, it's been a little while since we've caught up.
We actually talk less than every 2 weeks, but we don't always see each other's face.
Yeah, well, yeah, we'll send each other movie
we talk
news
all the time, but yeah, we don't always see each other. So yeah, no, things have been good, hectic, lots of stuff going on, but it's been good. Yeah, we got you know, April stuff. I mean, spring is here. I think I've said that several times now, but I really think I'm on to something this time.
You think so?
But yeah, I think so. Our April 11th Ghostlight Mysteries, the magic show at the museum, is coming up this Friday after everybody hears this. We do still have a few seats left. And, you know, I've begged, I've cajoled, I have pleaded with people that they really are going to enjoy this. And I think and I know that everyone that's going to be there is. And people look at it and they go, oh, you know, seances. Oh, that's old news. I don't want to see that stuff. But this is not that. This is a professional magic recreation show. And people, you know, we had these guys at the conference a couple of years ago and people really loved it. And we do still have some seats left. If you're interested, grab some. You don't want to miss this. You really don't. It's going to be a lot of fun. So
is this like the trickster huckster? Here's the whole.
Yeah, it's like here's how it happens. I mean, it was the stuff that, you know, Houdini and Keller and Thurston and those guys were doing on stage to show how, you know, the fraudulent mediums made, you know, spirits appear. But they don't reveal how the tricks are done, only that they can be done, which is what's going to be happening on Friday, which is why this event at the museum is going to be so cool. But
that's awesome.
Anyway, so the following week we have Devil Came to St. Louis dinner. Again, I've got just a couple of seats left. That's a popular date. I do it every year on Good Friday, which I know seems seems like sacrilegious in some way, but I swear it isn't.
Yeah.
Because everything sort of came to a head over Easter weekend in the real story.
Right.
So in a way, it's a kind of a, you know, an anniversary commemoration.
Right.
Sort of.
Also,
in
I fact, don't care.
This yeah. year's, I know, but this year's pretty darn close to when it actually happened. So, yeah, it's kind of cool. So anyway, again, just a couple of spots left for that. And then wrap it up April, honestly, with things that are still available as a Ghosts of the River Road tour on the 25th and a Limp family dinner on the 26th. And that's about it. I've really kind of filled up everything which is probably good because the weekend before the Ghosts of the River Road thing, I've got to go back to L.A. to film more stuff for that Lawrence Fishburne, which I found out is not The Unexplained. That's the Dan Aykroyd show that I did last when I went to New York. This is the History's Greatest Mystery show. So it's not the same show. It's different. And Lawrence Fishburne, Dan Aykroyd, not the same person.
I wasn't sure what you could talk about with this because it's in parentheses. So I was going to wait.
Yeah, I can't. Well, I can. I can say that it's for that show. I just can't talk about what it's about. Although I will tell you that the one I filmed out there last year about John Dillinger, which again, I couldn't say what that was about. That one is going to air on April 28th, unless that changes. So if you can watch History's Greatest Mysteries, and I think you can watch it online or you can watch it for free online. And I think you can probably watch it on 50 different streaming places if you don't have real TV anymore, which I don't even personally know anyone who still has cable, but I'm sure there are people out there. But if you are and you're one of them, April 28th is the episode that I will be on, unless that changes. And then if it does, I'll put something out, I'm sure.
So, tell your grandparents if they have cable or something.
Exactly. So other than that, I'm just going to keep mentioning the Haunted America Conference because the dates just keep ticking closer and closer.
Oh my gosh.
You know, we did add a ghost hunt. So for anybody complaining about the fact that all the ghost hunts were already sold out, we did add one at a very cool location. And we still have workshops and things available, but we are starting to fill up. I mean, it is ticking just like it did last year, and we will be, you know, a couple weeks out. I mean, things will be shut off. So if you are thinking of coming, now is the time. Go to ghostconference.net, get signed up. If you want information about the Ghostlight Mystery Show or any of the other stuff that I'll be doing this month, just go to dinnerandspirits.com, and there we are.
So, I can't believe, the conference is back already.
I know.
Every year we say the same thing.
I know, it's coming up. Yeah, it is coming up fast. I mean, we've still got, 2 months to, we've got a couple of months to go, but still, it'll be here before we know it. I was in Galena this past weekend at the other ghost conference that I usually do every year around this time. And we were all talking about, there were a lot of people there. So, hey, by the way, thank you to everyone who came. I had a lot of people who told me to tell you hi and who listened to the podcast. And we had a lot of people who then we'll see again in June. People have been coming to both. So it was a lot of fun. It always is. And Galena is such a cool little town.
Yeah.
And so, it was really great to see everybody. And so if you were there and I saw you, hello again. So,
I got a lot of guff from one particular Taylor Swift fan.
She was there. Mm-hmm. And I had a woman who told me to tell Cody hi. I said, Cody never comes to this stuff. So she told me to give you a hard time.
I don't like to leave.
There it is.
But I will be at the Haunted America Conference. And again this year. So it's going to be June 28th was my father's birthday.
Right. So it'll be. Yeah, that'll be right. I'm going to birthday on Saturday.
Exactly. Yeah. So I'll probably try to do something weird, you know, talk to some people, get behind a curtain, you know, why not, you know?
And there you go. Why not?
Yeah. So, see what happens. I want to give a quick shout out to some of our new patrons. So thank you very much for subscribing to Eric, Bethany, Adam, Rebecca, Heather, Jackie, Suzanne, Elizabeth, and Ellen. And I hope y'all are enjoying the really disgusting season.
I talked to some people about that this weekend too. They said, we listened to the Patreon show, and they're all like, well, you warned us. And I'm like, yep, I did. I warned everybody. We've got 5 seasons of that alternative podcast that we do. The one that we're doing right now is called Monster, and this season is about Albert Fish. And I can promise you that if you give it a try, try. Give it a listen. You will never see peanut butter in the same way again.
Good.
Anyway, we offer this show every other week, so it kind of fits in with the regular run of this show. So you get a new episode every single week with no waiting, just by signing up at our Patreon page, which is patreon.com/AmericanHauntings.
Awesome. Well, we have a quick listener review real quick. And this one.
Oh, is, great.
This one's from
Rick. Is this one of the ones from all the people who hate us? Because this season has attracted a lot of people who don't apparently like us or this season.
It has.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't say us. I should mostly just say me. But yeah. That's OK. I mean, yeah. You know, whatever. I think enough people like the season that I think we're OK.
Yeah, so it's also attracted a lot of person. But anyway,
a lot of weirdos.
The listen, yeah, one single person. The listener review, yeah. Anyway, is from Rick, and it's titled "The Exorcism of Emily Rose and Demons." And this one is gonna get it's a little nerdy and like into the weeds, but I like it. Definition of demon. See Albert Fish. Uh-huh. Demons don't have to be supernatural. Great job on both podcasts. Sorry, I don't use a secret code name, Rick. I get what he means. Like, I get the definition of demon, but like true
people,
that was living, I know. Breathing.
I know. Yeah, you could look at a demon as this supernatural creature, which may or may not exist, but I don't think that you can question whether or not human monsters exist, like exactly. Albert Fish did. So yeah, it's been quite a run.
Yeah.
For Patreon. So we're only on episode 7 and already I don't think anybody has bailed on us.
Yeah.
You know, with the episode, we keep bringing in more new people, but I will say it's everyone seems to top the last and pretty much how horrible it is. So,
right.
Yeah. Anyway,
I've talked about, a piece of art that I did in collaboration. It said, you know, all monsters are human sort of thing. And it's like, you know, I haven't dealt with any poltergeist activity, but, I've felt some things, this and that, but, people from the afterlife may have pushed me, brushed up against me, all that. Never hit me in the face straight up, you know, like a living person has, yeah, you know?
Right,
like,
right.
And sure. So be sure. Afraid of the living.
That makes sense. Yeah.
That's what I say.
It does kind of make sense to, you know, to be afraid of all that, because yeah, there's some wild stuff out there. And like I said, we're covering it in this for sure. So yeah, anyway. We, as a show that people seem to like, we appreciate your comments. For those of you who do like them, I know that some of you don't. And I don't know if you're hoping that you will get your review read because you tell us how much we suck. But people can just go and read that on their own. We're not going to give you a reward for that as you like to say, a bribe. It isn't a bribe. It is just a reward. We just like it when you post reviews. And what's funny about it is that by posting the reviews that some people are posting, all it does is send more people to our podcast.
That's how the algorithm works.
Yeah, that's how the algorithm works. So we're not going to send you anything cool in the mail if you tell us how much you hate us. But if you send us or post a good review, one that does actually make sense and, you know, attach relevance to the show, we will send you something cool in the mail. We'll read yours. If you read it, you hear us read your review, drop us a line on the hotline at 217-791-7859. Just send us your address and I'll send you something cool in the mail.
Yeah.
So, and free stuff in the mail. So there you go.
And the beautiful thing is with the black box that is Apple, podcast,
yes.
They do have, you know, some metrics that are obviously correlated and stuff. But if you leave us a 1-star review, but then you keep listening to every single episode, that sends a certain signal
to
Apple. And so you're going to see more of us.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So that kind of defeats the purpose. So
the best thing
you can do is stop leaving the reviews, and better yet, unsubscribe.
Yeah.
Because if you don't like this show, why are you listening? Anyway, let's discuss this episode.
Yeah. Oh, so. we're gonna dive into something that Troy loves even more. So is this truly the last time?
No, God, no. I know I said that. And I think I already corrected myself. I know I said in the Amityville Horror episode from last season that I was not going to talk about the Warrens anymore. But yes, I did have to. And in fact, because we're going to cover the four movies that have been based on their cases that people have actually seen. There actually are a couple more, including a TV movie, which is really bad, which does not star Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga.
Were you in it?
No, I am not in it. But there is another one based on one of their things that we're not going to cover. But we will cover two more with our, you know, heroic characters played by Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga. And then we'll cover one other Warren case before we move on. And then I think I will put a complete ban on any further mention of the Warrens in the podcast.
so it's kind of like,
but it was hard. You know, we can't talk about based on a true story and leave out these films.
Right.
I mean, there's just no way to do it. I mean, we could. I mean, I had enough other ones, but I wanted to get some stuff in there that I knew that people had seen and that maybe they would wonder about.
Yep.
You know, and like I said, my opinions are my own when it comes to them. But I've tried to kind of offer up some evidence and some of this stuff that, they weren't exactly on the up and up. And I don't think I'm the only one who feels that way. If you're offended by it, I apologize. But in this case, when we say based on a true story, what we mean is that the names are the same. And that and that's roughly it. The fact that this family moved into this house, accurate. Beyond that, as far as the movie goes, dude, that's about it. I mean, honestly, I rewatched the movie again after I had written up the true story section.
Okay.
And so then I watched the movie again so that I could kind of incorporate a lot of that back into it. And while I enjoy the movie, I do. I mean, it's got a great cast.
I mean, everybody's
great in it. It is the first one is still my favorite. Although really, I even like the third one as goofy as it is. I've liked all of them. It's just that, I mean, I'm a sucker for the Annabelle movies, the Nun, all of it, even though they have no, you know, connection to real life whatsoever other than names. But other than that, I do really enjoy them. But, you know, if you're looking for something that's true and accurate, this isn't it, you know.
It's kind of almost a double-edged sword, because I love The Conjuring. I think it's a good movie. I think it's a scary movie.
Oh, yeah.
It brings more people into the fold. However, with a bunch of misinformation, you know. But also it did great things for like horror movies and the genre in general.
Oh, absolutely.
Was it the franchise, 2.2 billion is what it's saying.
It's definitely been great for horror. That's for sure.
Exactly. Yeah. So you can't leave it out. You can't shutter it. But then you do have a lot of people coming in asking a bunch of questions about, you know, this and that. And the other thing, usually it's Annabelle stuff or.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
did this really happen? Did that really happen? And so you spend a lot of time. I mean, I can't imagine what it's like for like Andrea Perrin to get the questions, because, you know, I know that her mother saw the movie before she passed away and wasn't thrilled. Which is understandable. I mean, I'd be happy to have, you know, Lily Taylor playing me if I were her. that's just part of the great cast in this. But, you know, on the other hand, I just some of the stuff that goes on in this movie, especially toward the end when things really get out of hand, you know, and spoiler alert, I think that I kind of covered that already, that, you know, she becomes possessed and tries to kill one of the kids. And it's like, man, that really didn't happen. And I mean, not the least of which is all the stuff with, you know, Bathsheba and stuff. I mean, who was a real person? But, and again, I don't even blame Carolyn for this, because I get it. I've been there. You know what? I've talked about this 1,000 times. It was really hard to research stuff back then, especially back then. I mean, it was hard enough in the early 90s when I started doing it. Imagine what it was like back in the 70s.
Yeah, you just show up.
Had access to anything.
Right.
You know, she's got just people telling her stories. And, you know, if you know, every town has its local haunted house and its local folklore and its local legends, and they just passed them all along to her. And she didn't know any better. You know, she just took it for gospel, that this is, hey, these people should know, they live here. And so she just assumed that there really was a witch who lived in her house or lived, in the area, at least on the farm or whatever, that murdered her kids and all kinds of stuff. You know, it wasn't her fault, but, you know, I mean, boy, did they run that one. Did they really take them for a ride when the war showed up?
Well, you did talk about right place, right time.
And, oh, yeah, absolutely.
And it is very much also like people just showing up and just be like, hey, we weren't invited.
Yeah, but, yeah, it was a different time back then, too. But, you know, and they were at the right place at the right time. And, you know, I have a lot of respect for the fact that they became so well known for what they were doing. Mm-hmm. Now, if, you know, somebody asked me, I was watching that last night and Sam had asked me, she said, do you think the Warrens really believe they were legitimate? Mm-hmm. And I looked at that in a funny way because there's a lot of stuff that isn't like, it's public, but it's not. And I don't know that we'll get into all of it just because it's really outside of what we're doing. But there is a lot of stuff about Ed Warren that has since come out that leads me to believe he was rather manipulative. Mm-hmm. And I have often wondered if Lorraine, who was much younger than he was when they met, if he didn't convince her that she was really something more than she was. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that she was a fraud. She certainly could have been empathic in some way, but I often think that he fed into a lot of the things that she was doing and blew them out of proportion. Now that's an opinion, but it does lead me to wonder after reading a lot of their stuff and finding a lot of their stuff and going through it and knowing about some of the things that aren't widely public that nobody really wants to talk about, that there were some things going on that lead me to believe that maybe he, you know, kind of played things a bit. I think he was definitely a con man or at least a carnival type showman. You know what I mean?
Entertainer.
An entertainer, really. And I wouldn't even say that I think he was malicious.
Right.
I just think he really wanted attention and wanted the money that came with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that that's where a lot of this comes from, with the way that you work people and convince them that they're in trouble. And, you know, I've always talked about, you know, their quote unquote museum that they had at their house, because it really, you think of a museum as something that's on display, and that was really just more like a warehouse for weird stuff. But it's almost like you could just like wander into somebody's house and go, wow, this really seems to be haunted. I should probably take this with me. It's a great way to get antiques.
Sure.
You know? You know, so, you know, some of that stuff that, I mean, you can't go by the movie because there was no little, you know, wind up toy thing with a mirror on it that, you know, that none of that was real. So
great for the
if
movie.
if that was in real life in the museum, I would question the authenticity of that item. But you know, some of the other stuff, I mean, the Annabelle story, there's just so many problems with that story, with the no names, no real reports, no evidence of anything other than their version of the story. And it makes a great story. It's a great story. And it has spawned an ongoing universe franchise, you know, with all the Conjuring films. And the movies are fun, but even just looking at the doll in the movie, it's obviously not the same doll. I mean, it's obviously not what it really looked like. It's a Raggedy Ann doll.
Right.
And I'm sure there were probably some, as far as the movie goes, probably some rights issues with using Raggedy Ann. Kind of like in The Monkey, when they couldn't use the monkey that's described in Stephen King's story with clanging the cymbals, because Disney owns the rights to that monkey with the clanging cymbals on film because it was in Toy Story.
Yes, yes.
So it had to be changed. And I'm sure that's why. Plus, Raggedy Ann is not scary looking.
No.
And the doll in Annabelle is very scary looking, which again begs the question, what kind of kid would play with that doll?
Mm-hmm.
None. No child would play with that doll. Not in real life.
I'll tell you, it's everything. Yes, I agree with everything you said. And even if even if they could have used the Raggedy Ann doll, they probably, you know, wouldn't have, just for aesthetic purposes. But
yeah,
my sister.
But yeah, because you'd laugh when you saw it. You know, I mean, you know,
my sister Cassidy's a twin, and her twin passed away at birth. And my aunt, I believe, gifted her like a porcelain doll that looked just like her. And it scared the shit out of my sister. She swears that it would move and do this and that.
Well,
and the other
that would actually scare me. Gave me that doll.
Well, that's what I'm saying is maybe the kid wasn't playing with it.
But it didn't look like some kind of, you know, horror monster thing like the Annabelle doll.
Yeah,
I'll say
it's 60% of the way there. But yes, yeah, the Annabelle was way worth.
I mean, all dolls are creepy in a way. I mean, they're all a little creepy anyway. But
maybe, you know, maybe somebody gifted it to her. I don't know. But I remember it used to sit in this little wooden rocking chair, and it would just be perfect for. I never saw this, but it'd be perfect for just rocking back and forth. Like they gave my sister a horror movie setup for her dead twin. You know,
that's
like
so creepy.
I know. I'm gonna see. Yeah. I don't know where the doll is. I hope it's not in existence anymore. But I'll see if anybody has it. I'll take a picture.
If it is, we can put it in the museum.
Oh, that's honestly.
Yeah. Yeah.
One thing I wanted to know. Okay, facts that are not disputed. Does this place really have 14 rooms and only one bathroom?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you got to remember the bathroom would have been added later. You know what I mean? Because I mean, you're talking about a house when it was built. I mean, that's a pretty early home, and there was no indoor plumbing at the time. So there was definitely an outhouse. And, you know, so when there was a bathroom put in, they probably squeezed it into some closet somewhere or something, you know, like they did. Just for instance, I mean, I've been in houses that have been restored or that have been changed, and they're, you know, they put bathrooms in pantries or whatever extra room they can, you know, use to put in an indoor bathroom. So yeah, that would be why. And as mentioned, the bathroom was downstairs. The bedrooms were all upstairs, you know. Mm-hmm. So one bathroom in a house that big is not really that surprising, but really inconvenient.
Right.
Especially
right.
when you have all those girls, who, you know, as they get older, are going to need time in the bathroom every day to get ready for school.
Right.
That's going to take a long time to do.
Oh, so, gosh.
I think if you live there today, you definitely would put in another bathroom.
Yeah. Well, no, it sounds somewhere miserable. Yeah. Yeah. So something you mentioned about the Warrens was, you know, having all their ducks in a row when they kind of arrive, and I understand a lot of that, but I also wanted to ask, and I think I've talked about this before, but do you think there's anything to not them manifesting, but them bringing out stuff because of who they are and what they were trying to do sometimes?
Maybe. I mean, maybe, you know, if Lorraine really did have some sort of empathic to her. Yeah, I mean, I would think if they went into a place that was genuinely haunted, you know, maybe that could stir up activity. And some might say that's what happened here because, you know, yes, there were things already going on, but things got worse after they came and sort of stirred things up again. And, you know, initially, you know, Carolyn, you know, they act in the movie, you know, they're begging them to come and help them. But in real life, they just showed up one day, and Carolyn had no idea who they were. None whatsoever. Never heard of them. Never anything. And, you know, but once they got in there and kind of weaseled their way in, it was kind of hard to get rid of them, although eventually in real life they did. And what happened was nothing like what happens in the movie. You know, they were having a seance and, you know, something happens and Roger says, okay, that's it. Get out of here. You know? And then they didn't come back. And what was also not mentioned in the movie is that the Warrens blamed the family for the fact that the ghosts were still there, because they said, well, you know, since they weren't Catholic and that their lack of faith was what was doing it. And that was something that I think that the parents did take some offense to, especially when the movie came out, was because it made it sound like they were like these, you know, wild heathens. And they actually did go to church. They just didn't happen to be Catholic, you know. And so that was the problem as far as, you know, Everyone seemed to be concerned.
So. I like to think that maybe time is a flat circle, and it was actually me and you after we passed on messing with the Warrens because we were just so mad at all their shenanigans, you know, that day.
I think we're probably pretty far down the list of people who are unhappy with the Warrens. I would say a good portion of the people who dealt with them, I would say, probably were unhappy.
That is a very, very good point. What are your experiences or connections or anything with any of the places from the movies or things with the movies, any of the real life locations, any of your?
Not for me personally. No, I hadn't been to the house. I mentioned Norma Sutcliffe in that was really my first real, and that was after the movie came out, but that was my first real connection to the place after it, the movie had come out and all of the hype and the hoopla was out there, because she had contacted me. I spoke to her several times over the phone. She sent me a big packet of information about the farm and everything that was wrong with the movie, all the things that were misstated and, you know, wrong information and all the stuff about Bathsheba. She had been working with this journalist and they had put all this stuff together and did a big presentation at like their town historical society, because she and her husband had just had it. They were done. They had it up to here with the vandals and the trespassers. It was constant. After the movie came out, it was on and on and on. It just was happening like every night.
Yeah.
And that was really upsetting for them. And they eventually filed a lawsuit against Warner Brothers and who was the distributor of the film and a whole bunch of other people, including the director, the production company, everything. They, you know, it got settled out of court. Nothing really ever came of the lawsuit, but then they turned around and sold the house a couple of years later, and really cleaned up on it, you know. So, but that was my first real interaction with anything to do with the house is when she had contacted me. And that's been, I want to say that was like 2014. So maybe a year after the movie came out. So it's been quite a while. I have not visited the property just because I really don't see the point in it. I mean, I understand that, you know, some people do believe that it is still haunted, and it certainly could have been when the parents were there. There's no reason to think that it, you know, that they made the whole thing up. That seems like a long way to go to, you know, to just try to get your story out there. And people say, oh, well, you know, I think I mentioned this too, that, oh, you know, that she was a fraud because she, you know, didn't have a traditional publisher go do her book. That means nothing. That doesn't mean anything, especially these days, you know? So I think that she was telling the truth. And I think that the things that are documented in her books are not what you see in the movie. That's kind of what makes it more realistic to me. And I think that the people who have had it since then have really kind of cashed in on the hype of the movie rather than what happened in real life. Because again, my question is that I ask when I was telling the story was, why did nothing happen for 40 years? And then suddenly, you know, just because the house is sold a couple of times and it's back in the news, now suddenly it's haunted again. I you know, that kind of makes me a little leery about the, you know, truthfulness behind it. I'm not saying people are liars. I'm just saying that it would be easy to imagine things, you know, people being fed, you know, all the hype from the movie. You go there expecting it to be haunted. And of course, that's what you find, you know. So, again, I'm not saying the house isn't haunted. I'm just saying that, you know, I don't know, man. It's hard to say. But yeah, I know that there's been a lot of recent things that I'm not going to get into all that. I know there's been a lot of, you know, bad things said about boycotts and all kinds of things about the house. And I don't know those people, so I don't have any comment on that. But I will say that it does make me wonder, you know, how all this happened when so much of this stuff is problematic and, you know, 40 years is a long, long time to not have any activity for it to suddenly start happening again.
Right.
That's just my opinion.
And, you know, we like to, you know, separate, you know, fact from fiction and history from hauntings and things. But I think a lot of, I do want to make it clear, a lot of the stuff we talk about with the Warrens and things is kind of from one of our original premises where it's just, we don't like people taking advantage of other
I mean, I feel like that happened a lot, and I feel like it definitely happened in this case. And well, honestly, in all of the films we're going to cover, which, really are kind of their most famous cases, I think that, they had such a loose connection with the truth that things just get a little blurry, mm-hmm. But the stories are still interesting. The parts of it, I thought that the Perrin family's experiences and their story was interesting completely on its own. Mm-hmm. I mean, it bears no resemblance really to the movie other than it happened at the same place. Well, I mean, the movie version at the same place. And it is both about ghosts, but that's, probably to the extent of it. But
right.
Even so, it's still a cool story. And it does, of course, make the movie based on a true story, which mm-hmm. is what we're doing here with this.
Yes. And I love this has happened, sure, before The Conjuring. But one of the most iconic things, well, two of them. One is eventually you get to see what they're fighting against,
right.
up close and personal, which I thought was great. But I do love the scene hanging up the laundry outside and having the wind blowing. And
I know there's some really good stuff. I mean, not only, like the scene with the hand clap when the girl, they're playing the hand clap,
yes.
the clapping hide and seek. I mean, that in itself is scary. I love the part with, like you said, with the sheet outside. I there's so many really good parts to that, really iconic kind of modern horror scenes that really make the movie something special.
Yeah.
You just have to, you can't judge it and say, oh, well, that's nothing like what really happened. I know that's what I just did with this whole episode, but I was just trying to tell the real story behind it, honestly. And, I mean, that's all we were trying to do with it, but it is a great movie. It really is. And I think that the second one, not as great, but we're going to tell it anyway.
I love the second one.
Do you?
I really do.
I have a hard, the problems I have with it. Well, I mean, we're going to get to that next time. But the problems I have with the second one are so ingrained in the fact that the Warrens really had absolutely nothing to do with that story. Less so than this one, a lot less so than this one. And yet it's told from their perspective and they didn't have one. That's my problem.
Okay.
We'll get back to that. I mean, I've spoken to the investigator, he's passed away now, but I spoke to the guy who was actually there
mm-hmm.
and he said that when the Warrens came by one afternoon, that the only thing he ever talked to Ed about was Ed trying to convince him that he could really make a lot of money off this.
Oh my God.
That was literally it. So, I mean, I have a hard time, trying to sort that one out, but whatever. It's still a great story. It's an iconic story and we're going to talk about it no matter what.
I'm excited.
So it's going to be fun. So
awesome. Is there anything we didn't cover, you think? I mean,
not really. If somebody has a question that we didn't answer, or if they just want to tell us that, they love the Warrens and that we're full of it, that's okay too. I don't agree on that. I think the Warrens were full of it, but I mean, we are too, but not about this, I don't think. But,
right.
I'm happy to listen if somebody's got a take on this that I'm not seeing. I'm happy to listen, we may not agree, but I'm happy to listen.
I mean, hey, keep listening to the show, leave a one-star review, put the Warrens in there for good search.
Whatever you
visibility.
Want.
It'll care. Help.
Yeah, whatever you want.
I don't have any ghostwriters this time, but I bet you probably have some hotlines.
I do have a few. Yeah. In fact, we have one that's some pretty good news. But let me, before I get to that, I've got a couple of others. So, this is the section where we talk about the hotline and the messages and the text messages that we get. You can text us on the hotline at 217-791-7859. And it might get read on the show. But I do have one from Ellen in the 618. She said she was at Dead of Winter, but she didn't get a chance to ask us because we were talking about Agnes Moorhead in the episode that I was talking about at mm-hmm. Dead of Winter, about John Wayne when he did the Conqueror and all the people that died from the nuclear contaminated sand in Utah. And she mentioned that I mentioned Agnes Moorehead, who was also in Dora on Bewitched, but she said she was also involved in the Bewitched curse. Now, I did not know about the Bewitched curse. I still don't. I haven't really looked into it yet. I've forgotten until I literally opened this text message to read it to you gotten it.
Is it about the male actor?
Well, yeah, it's probably got something to do with Dick York and Dick Sargent.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Dick York, I think he was first. Yes, he played Darren for most of the time. And then toward he got really sick, all kinds of back problems. And he ended up being replaced in the season by, I believe, Dick Sargent. I believe that's the order they came in. And when I was a kid, I didn't know the difference. They look so much alike that it didn't throw. I mean, now I look back and I go, OK, definitely not the same guy. But when I was a kid, I did not notice that Darren had changed, but he did. But so I will look into the Bewitched curse and I'll let you know next time what that's about. So because now I'm kind of curious and I want to know more. So I'll check it out. And so thank you, Ellen, for letting us know about that. So this one comes to us from Lauren in the 402, and it says, "Hey, Cody and Troy, my name is Lauren. I recently caught up with the podcast. Woohoo. I first started listening to you guys back in 2017 on your website. I lost you guys for a few years because she listened on her school computer and had to turn that in every summer." That was in parentheses. Mm-hmm. "I only remembered you guys in mid-2023. Oh, that's kind of sad. But anyway, I now listen on Spotify and love the show so much. I finally caught up since I resumed listening. I even re-listened to season one. I loved hearing the story of Charles Starkweather as he's from my state. My dad heard from my aunt and grandfather that people left the keys in their cars at the end of the driveway with money on the seat, probably hoping that he didn't kill them. Anyway, I love that you guys discuss the history that goes along with the hauntings. I've learned so much. Hope to get to one of your events soon. Thanks so much for the incredible podcast, Lauren S."
Oh, so somebody forgot about us, which I totally understand, but then remembered.
Yeah.
Wow, so, that's weird.
All right. So I have some good news. And before I get to the really good news, I want to mention this. And I have to mention this because it came to us from Diana, who is our podcast listener of the year.
Yeah.
But she had made a suggestion to Robbie, who was looking for that missing book. Remember, that has been an ongoing saga for a while. And she had some suggestions. She said that Daniel Cohen and Catherine Tucker Windham were the gateways to ghost stories when she was in elementary school. Because what what 8-year-old should have been studying pictures of the Brown Lady of Raymond Hall and the Watertown Ghosts on the Clouds and the Bell Witch. So Diana sent that in, and I wanted to make sure that I did mention that as she tried to help out. But good news came in today at 2:12 p.m.
Okay,
from Robbie, and said, "We figured it out. The author name suggested by other listeners got me started in the right search direction. Eventually, it led to a picture of the book's cover, and that rang a bell. So my cousin and I were able to locate a couple of old copies and bought them. And as it turns out, the book is called True Ghost Stories by Pat McCarthy. The illustrations are just like I remembered. Maybe not quite as scary now, but still the same effect. Many thanks for all the suggestions that got the book hunt headed in the right direction. Kind of nice being able to grab back a little bit of my childhood." And then Robbie sent a couple of pictures along. And I've never seen this book before. But I do see what they mean about the pictures. The pictures are, you know, eerie kind of line drawings, you know. But so that was the book. True Ghost Stories, Tales of the Supernatural Based on Actual Accounts, edited by Pat McCarthy, illustrated by Richard D. Maccabee. Wow. It's a red book cover. It sold for 95 cents originally. So
Everywhere I see right now is out of stock.
Yeah. So I'm sure it's not easy to find, but apparently it is out there. We helped a little bit.
We did something good.
So something good came out of that search for that book. Because, boy, I had no clue on that one.
Only took us nine seasons to do something good.
I get crowdsourcing it must have done the trick. So
that's awesome.
Anyway, guys, if you have any text messages that you'd like to send us, you can text us on the Haunt Line at 217-791-7859. And we'll save those up for the next show, or sometimes I answer them ahead of time. I've had a few that I answer, and some of the texts don't have anything to do with the podcast. I think people just use it to ask questions about events and stuff. So those get answered a little quicker than the ones we use for the podcast.
Is my house anyway, haunted?
Yeah, it's you know, it's not quite that bad, but it's, you know, it's just usually questions that people have about something that's going on. So anyway, if you're good, I'm good. I'll wrap this thing up. So thanks again for checking out the story and the postmortem for this week's episode. We hope you love the show. And if you do, we hope you'll share it with your friends, family, strangers, or even people you meet on the street. Encourage them to listen. And if you get a chance, we hope you go to iTunes and leave us a review, even if you don't listen there. And if you do leave a review, as I mentioned, we'll be reading at least one of them during each postmortem. And if we read yours, we'll send you some cool stuff in the mail. Also, it really helps us if you check your iTunes, if that's how you listen, and make sure the American Hauntings podcast is set to automatically download to your feed. You'll never miss a show that way, and it always helps us out. And we'll reward you for that, too. You see, we have a discount code that you can use to get 10% off any books, tours, or events you purchase from American Hauntings. Just use the code PODCAST at checkout, and you could save a few bucks. Because just remember, American Hauntings is more than just a podcast. It's also books, tours, ghost hunts, events, the Haunted America Conference, and the American Oddities Museum in Alton, Illinois. And you can find everything about us on our website at AmericanHauntings.net.
All righty. Well, this episode of the American Hauntings podcast was written and narrated by Troy Taylor and was produced and edited by me, Cody Beck. To find out more about the show, check out show notes or go to our website at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com. If you want to find out more about the podcast, you can reach us via email, by text on the Haunt Line, or on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Threads, Blue Sky, and
Threads and Blue Sky.
I'm there, but man,
I don't understand how the algorithm works, and I can't figure out how you get stuff in order, and yeah, I don't look at it very often, so I apologize if anyone's gone there looking for us. We're there, but
yeah, go more old school people. Yeah, if you want to talk to us.
Yeah, it's a little easier.
Hey, thanks again for listening. We couldn't and definitely wouldn't do it without you, so until next time, goodbye,
so long,
see you later. I cannot wait for the reviews that we're gonna get.
I know, after this. Just don't care.
Yeah, don't care. Give a fuck.
This weekend only at Macy's, it's our lowest prices of spring. How low? Diamond rings, pendants, and earrings, only $399, originally $1,500. Ninja blenders, now $89.99. And $395 men's designer suits, only $99.99. So if you're wondering why you should shop Macy's lowest prices sale, well, the name pretty much says it all. It's our lowest prices for one weekend only. Starts tomorrow at Macy's. Savings off already reduced prices. Exclusions apply.